Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDilling. I'm very excited to be here today with Savari Gentle. Also here, John Purcell.
Yay.
Hello.
Hi.
Savari, you have a new Rolly Sinclair book out.
I do. Oh, well, about to come out.
About to come out, A Dangerous Language. Could you tell us a little bit about what Roland is up to in this book?
In this book, he is getting a little bit more involved with the communist cause. Unintentionally, it's mainly because, in his usual way, he sees a place where he can help, and injustice, and he finds himself embroiled in it. In 1935, a wonderful man named Egon Kish came to Australia, and he was one of the first anti-war activists. He had spent some time in a concentration camp in Germany, and he travelled the world trying to tell people what was happening in Germany, what the Nazis were up to. And of course, when he tried to come to Australia, we tried to keep him out. And the case became a very famous one. It went to the High Court. The White Australia policy was used to bar him from entry because the Lyons government did not want him in the country because he was a renowned communist as well as being an activist. Rowley becomes embroiled in all of that. There's a body on the steps of Parliament House which he also has to address in the process, and it just takes him a little bit further on his journey into the politics of the time, I think.
I always learn so much, like, as well as just being a rollicking good story, I always learn things when I read your books. So I feel a bit embarrassed to admit, but I have not ever heard of Egon Kish, and so I found all of that really interesting, and I love the way that you're able to weave in the real historical figures with your fictional characters so seamlessly, because it can be so hard to pull that off, don't you think?
Oh, it's extraordinarily difficult.
Often, I love to read historical fiction, but often when it's based on fictional characters and someone real shows up, it breaks the spell for me. But it never happens with your books.
Thank you. Well, I really like the idea of using history as a scaffolding for a story. So I don't actually mess with history. I like the history to stand as it was. So I don't actually have them have historical characters doing something that's not coherent with the historical record. But there is so much to write in between. So the Rowley stories are in fact just woven into this historical scaffolding that exists. For me, that makes it really easy to write. Not just because it gives structure, but because I'm actually fascinated with the history of the time. I'm not an historian, so quite often the first time I'm seeing this history is when I'm writing the book, and when I'm doing the research as I'm writing the book.
Do you, like, I wanted to ask you this, because interspersed throughout is newspaper clippings and stuff. When I imagine you researching this book, I imagine you in the bottom archives of libraries, like, reading. Is this true?
That's such a romantic image. Please hold on to that. But no. I'm an extreme pantser, so I don't plot at all. I just sit down and I write. My approach to research is, as I'm writing the story, when I come to a place where I need to know something of historical fact, then I go and research it at that point. I have a computer, so no longer do I have to climb around in archives.
I'm going to retain the mental image.
That's what I'm doing in my heart.
Okay,
great. Really, I'm just typing into Trove. and the newspaper articles, in fact, I actually find them after the novel's written.
Okay.
Part of that is I don't ever want to be in a position where I am writing the story to fit the history. Where I'm sort of, you know, taking twists and turns because I want to include a particular newspaper article. The story's got to have integrity of itself, and the history is a scaffolding, yes.
I loved the one, and I wrote down the title of this little article that was in there about the vogue of the thriller.
Oh, yes.
That was really interesting to me, and I'm hijacking this a bit because I haven't let John say a single word yet.
It's just been very quiet.
I was waiting for you're talking about book 8, but I just wanted to talk about the rebranding of the whole series, and also the sort of steady growth of popularity of the series over the time. And also, just to, as an author, to sit back on book 8 and look back on all the others and go, look what I did. You know, there's that. There's a sense of achievement in creating a series like this and coming out with book 8. You know.
Yeah, I think so. Or there probably will be when you slow down enough to actually contemplate that. But, of course, I'm in the midst of writing book 9 at the moment.
Right.
So quite often when these things are happening, it's not really a sense of what I've done, it's more a sense of what I've still got to do. Mm. And there's more Rolly stories.
Good.
He hasn't finished with the
30s. I like to hear that.
And there's so much more that I want to actually explore with the Rolly books, that's where my mind is at. But the rebranding is fabulous, isn't it?
Gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Such gorgeous colours.
And I've got to admit, when Pantera first told me they were rebranding my books, I thought, oh no, people's sets. People are going to be so upset I'm wrecking their sets. And I did like the old covers, so I was a little bit cautious. And then when I saw the proofs for these new covers, I was just completely won away in the space of about a second and a half.
It's really fitting. They're really... not dissing the old covers at all, but these just really make sense.
Yes, they pop and they work and they seem to really take you back into that time. It's lovely to see the series grow, and it's probably, you know, it's probably more in accordance with Roland's approach to the world than an immediate bestseller, to just have this slow burn series that gains in popularity over books. But it's it is lovely, you know. More and more, I'm running into people who know Rolly, and I've always felt like when I meet readers, it's always felt a bit like Rolly's introducing me to people.
Yeah.
He's introducing me to a lot more nowadays. So, but it's always lovely. It's like having... I always describe it like meeting your children's friends. It's really always delightful.
No, he does feel like a friend.
Well, that one of the aspects for me as a bookseller is one thing that comes so often is I've just finished such and such series. I'm bereft. I don't know what to do. And as a bookseller, to be able to go, well, you can start this new series. And a lot of readers out there won't start something until they've got a good run. And they'll just get into it, and they just won't lift their heads until they've read the whole series.
Yes.
So this is that period for us, especially with the new branding, where you can go...
We have 8 books.
Yeah, 8 books.
Started.
Get stuck in. And just
it's like a binge read.
Yeah, exactly. An absolute binge read. So going back all the way to the beginning... as you say, you write the way you do. It seems impossible because, you know, from the very beginning, your knowledge of the era was everywhere. I can imagine that there was either a moment where you came up with a character and then went back and read a bit, or it just seems like you know too much about the period to do it the way you said you did.
This is the confession. When I started writing, I was writing the Hero Trilogy. And this was before I was published. And I happened to be married to an English history teacher. And he's that wonderful thing that all writers aspire to, a captive editor. And so, you know, my technique is I'd write something and I'd hand it to him to do a sort of a run-through to make sure that it was coherent and so on. So he'd edit for me. And I was handing him Greeks. And he was stopping every time he came across a name like Achilles and Agamemnon. And one day he just turned around to me and he handed me back the manuscript and he said, for God's sake, can't you write something with names like Peter and Paul in it? and at the time, you know, I ignored him because you do. But I had realised by then, I'd only just started writing, that it was an all-consuming task. That, you know, the writer's head is a wonderful place for a writer. There's people in there and worlds in there. We can be entertained for days and weeks. But it's difficult for the people we live with because all of a sudden they're living with someone who's not really all there. And so I knew I wasn't going to stop writing. And I had no immediate plans of getting rid of Michael either. So I had to...
No immediate plans.
I had to make them work together. And I think my theory was if I could bring him into my head, I wouldn't have to come out as often. And so he's an historian, And his particular area of expertise is the extreme political movements of the 1930s in New South Wales.
Well, well.
So I grabbed his history thesis and I found a story in it. And so it, in a way it's turned into this funny sort of collaboration on the research, in that I have an expert in the field in the bed next to me. And one of the things that I always say to people about research is, if you can find someone to talk to who knows the era, it is worth 1,000 textbooks. It's worth, 1,000 archives, because you can argue with them, you can test theories, you can see what works. And that's how the Roland Sinclair series has come into being, because, it's given us something to talk about, really. And Roland basically sits in the bed between us.
Secrets sounds from fun. The bedroom. What about novels of the period? Like, I spent years in secondhand bookshops, and all these novels would come through from the 30s. Have you read any of those?
No,
I want to ask about that, because Agatha Christie's mentioned in the book.
I wasn't Agatha Christie fan from the time I was a child, but I particularly now avoid books that intersect with subject and period for me, especially when I'm writing, because I have enough voices in my head. I don't need to add voices that belong to someone else. And so I actually try to keep that clean. So my knowledge of the fiction of that period is probably only cursory. It's, with titles and so on. It's the non-fiction that I start to really read to build that scaffolding for the story.
Yeah. Something that really gets irritates me when I read historical fiction is when you can hear the research. You can hear the person get up and go research. One thing you don't get in your books is that sense. It seems, maybe it's from the conversations you have with your husband, that it seems to have settled down. It doesn't seem to have hard edges at all. It just is casually thrown in.
Well, I think that's also because I don't do research. I don't research before I write. So what that means is that the novel is driven by the story, and the historical details that come into it are part of the story.
Right.
And if they're not part of the story, it doesn't matter how interesting I found them, they're not going in.
What about things like clothes and technology and things like that? Is there a second write that you go through? So you do the first, get the story down, you get the first draft down, everything's right. Do you ever go back and go, well, that wouldn't, I have to adjust that thing?
Did you research the car? That's what I
wanted. The car, you know how I researched the car? My husband's also a bit of a classic car fan. So he had these magazines of classic cars. And so, I just went in. And I knew Rolly drove a Mercedes, because I knew that it would have been a controversial car at the time. But also because I drive an old Mercedes as well. And so I kind of felt this affinity. But also, my husband is a big old Mercedes fan, and I was always quite amused by how wedded men get to their cars and a particular brand of cars. So Michael would do bizarre things, like if he was parking the Mercedes, he'd try and find another Mercedes so the car would have someone to talk to. Found that kind of nuts, but very, very male, and I wanted to bring that into the whole Rolly context, because he is quite, he is quite attached to his yellow Mercedes. So I did do that, but and I don't know if this is a spoiler alert, but at the end of book 7, Roland loses the Mercedes. I won't say how, but the Mercedes is gone, and that was a big tragic turning point in the series, and I did feel him mourning. I have done so much to the poor man over the series. He's been shot and stabbed and drowned, but it was losing the car. I felt his anger.
He was still grieving in this book, even though he's got a bright, shiny new one.
Yes, and the only way I could calm him down, I could feel how upset he was that I'd taken his car. And the only way I felt like I could make friends with him again is to go shopping for another one. So out came the old classic car magazines, and we went through to choose a car for Rolly.
I had to Google the It's Airflow.
It's the Airflow, yeah. Yes. That's the big reveal, everybody.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, well,
should we beat that out? We can beat that out.
No, well, it's okay. In the first chapter, so you don't have to. They'll know it as
I had to Google it to see what it looked like, because I'm such a car ignoramus, and I sometimes need the mental image of what we're talking about. But, yeah.
Well, it was quite... At the time, it was a very controversial car because it was the first... It's the first time they moved from that very beautiful square sort of sedans where everything was done with coachwork and in a series of boxes to the very rounded profile that you see that comes into the cars in the late 40s and the 50s. But at the time, the world was divided. It was considered incredibly modern, and some people thought it was incredibly, incredibly ugly. And it was the kind of car that would have people turning heads because it looked like nothing else.
So how do you stop yourself from becoming a car nerd when you start doing this research? Is there a point, I'm going to go this far and no further, and I'll stop myself there?
I think it's because I'm a girl.
Well, you sounded like one just then, the way you're talking.
Do you feel more like Edna feels on the subject?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm very much a car is, gets you from point A to point B. And I've always, I've always understood there's something about my husband that makes him much more wedded to cars and much more emotionally connected to what we're driving. And so, since we've been married, I've always just let him choose the cars. And I presume that's what Edna's like, they're just cars.
So you knew exactly where to hurt Rolly.
I didn't intend to. Well,
she always hurts Rolly. Poor Rolly. That's why we're there.
Really. He's a crime fiction hero. Fiction.
He's always getting fictional husband beaten up.
He knew what he was doing when he signed on to be a crime fiction hero. He's not just lying around and contemplating life. He's got to actually do something.
But constant heartbreak as well, pretty much. Well, longing. Constant longing for the unattainable woman.
He's fairly dedicated on that score, isn't he? But, it's that actually comes out of necessity. You can't ruin the sexual tension by getting the characters together.
Is it hard to manage that? Because you do it. In terms of having a long series and keeping these relationships going, like you've got the friendships with Rolly's core group, his like love for Edna, and also the brother relationship with Wilfred, and they never get stale, and you've kept it going over 8 books to the point where it's just you're there every time for some new development in those relationships. How do you manage that?
Well, I think sibling relationships are sibling relationships. They're never resolved. It's always because you're bonded with these people for life, there's always ups and downs. I think why Edna and Rolly work is before, even though he loves her, even though he's, absolutely passionate about her, first and foremost, she's his best friend. And I think that's why it works. Because, many, many people have had relationships with people who could have been lovers, but are friends. So... I think that, but it is tricky because you don't want to take it too far because you can't take it back. You don't want to alienate people by just boring them to death with this really long, unresolved. And both of them have affairs with other people through the series, so they, I suppose that keeps things moving. And certainly in this book,
I'm really territorial on Edna's behalf, even though it's like you can't imagine them actually getting together, and part of you doesn't want them to. When someone else shows up, I'm like, get away. So they both have something else on the side going on at the moment, and I'm like a bit complacent about Edna's because he's an idiot,
because she's always been that way.
Yeah, but Rolly's little romance in this one, I was like, I don't know about this. I don't know if I like you at all.
Well, it's I think it is tricky. But the reality is, if and when Edna and Roland ever get together, that will be the last book. Because
which
you can't
perfectly explains why you want it to happen, but you don't, because as a reader, I think you sense that their end game, and you don't really want to get to the end yet.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to write the end yet.
Yeah.
But it's that sort of thing. Well, nobody wants to read Mr. and Mrs. Sinclair Investigate.
Mm.
And
I
don't
mean, really... I wouldn't say I never want to read that. Now that you've put it that way, I'm like, well...
Well, you know, it has a sort of a heart-to-heart
yeah.
sort of... It feels like a different series.
Yeah, it's not quite where I want to go with the series. But it is tricky because you have to manage that. And you can't forget that either. Readers want to know in each book that Rowley still loves Edna and that Edna probably still loves him. But it's got to be done in a way that they don't look like they're stupid, mm-hmm. that they don't do anything about it. But it maintains that tension throughout.
So these days you're probably bumping into more Rowley experts, fans.
Yes,
I am. Do you need to keep, like when you start, you're writing book 9 now, how much do you go back? Do you have record? I don't understand how
I
you can
move
manage
forward.
It.
So my mind goes forward. So even when I'm writing a Rowley book, I don't go back.
But consistency, how do you manage to, is it just in the back of your mind, just keeping it all there? And you've
it
got,
must
you
be.
Know,
yeah,
seven,
it must
right,
be.
Books
I'd,
in your
I'd,
head.
Also, they lead, these guys are like these eccentric bohemians. They lead such madcap lives. Like, if you announced in the next book an event that I had never heard of that happened in the timeline of the previous books, I just assume that they got up to some mischief between books. Like,
yeah.
I think you've got a lot of freedom of movement there.
I think so. And, it was funny, Kylie Ladd, who is a wonderful writer from New South Wales, she explained it to me. I've always said that the way I write is using my subconscious much more than my conscious brain. And so when I write, I always write forward. I'm pretty much a one draft writer. I don't rewrite.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't plot. And that my method is to sit in my pajamas with my laptop and watch television while I write.
Excuse me?
I kind of get that because sometimes it's easy to do something if there's...
Exactly. I need to be slightly distracted. So it's always something like Midsummer Murders or Lewis, something that's, you know, fairly mellow that I can... And long form that you can sit there and watch. And I need about 30% of my brain distracted. So you can follow those stories without engaging fully. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is the story just comes out. And so my theory is it's a bit like when you're looking for a word that you've forgotten and you're thinking about it and you can't find it, go away and do something else, you find it. So I'm doing that on a grand scale. I'm finding thousands of words that I couldn't find if I was looking for them. And Kylie explains it to me. Scientifically, she's given me a reason for what I do, that it's my prefrontal cortex that can only really be accessed indirectly. And so that's what I'm engaging when I write. But I'm also, because I'm a lawyer, I'm also trained to choose my words precisely the first time. So that's probably why I don't need to redraft, because when I put a word down, it's exactly what I mean, rather than a word that's close.
There are a lot of writers listening to this weeping at the moment.
She just watches TV and a book happens.
And she doesn't have to change the words. She doesn't do the research.
Like the dream, really.
It just comes along.
But you know, a part of it makes sense to me because I think that there's something magical about creativity, and I think that your own head can get in your way. So if you distract that 30% of your brain with Midsummer Night's Murders, then you can more easily access that more creative centre.
Yeah, and that's what I find. If I'm concentrating, if the house is silent and there's libraries, you know, there was a couple of years ago, I was the eminent writer in residence at Old Parliament House, or at MOAD, Museum of Australian Democracy, which is Old Parliament House. And they gave me a beautiful ministerial office and silence and so on. And I just couldn't write.
I needed my pyjamas.
I was fully dressed and there was silence and they expected me to write. So I just ended up wandering the halls looking for stories and taking notes. And then I would, you know, leave Old Parliament House and go to my hotel room, get in my pyjamas, turn on the television, and I would write.
Did they know about this or no?
And now they do. But in reality, I just can't cope in silence and order. I just need to distract part of my brain. And I think, you know, the conscious brain is quite an inhibiting thing, and it's quite a self-conscious thing, and you have to sort of drop the self-consciousness and just trust that creative part of your brain when you're writing, and it just makes it easy. It may change. This is what it's been for the last, 10 or 11 books that I've written. It may, you know, tomorrow I may not be able to do it and I may have to come up with a plot.
But with 10 or 11 books, I think we've established a pattern.
I remember reading Peter Ackroyd's biography of Dickens, and I was astounded that he would have his study next to the lounge room where all the kids were messing around and conversations and guests and everyone there. And he's writing away and he goes, "And such and such," and joins in the conversation while he's writing away, and didn't want the door closed, wanted to keep in with the family but also be writing.
Oh, exactly. So, and, you know, I started writing when my youngest son was about one or two. And so I've always written in the middle of bedlam.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had a chance to write in quiet. So I think maybe my...
Well, you had the Parliament House, and it didn't work. Cross that off the list.
So maybe that's why the politicians are struggling, is to be quiet. Get them out of their offices. Put them in pyjamas, see what happens.
Midsummer Murders. Then we'll get some sometime.
Yeah, hide Midsummer Murders into... We get some legislation passed.
We're solving the world problems here.
Well, speaking of legislation, here's a segue. So in the book, there's a lot to do with the Immigration Act and the dictation test, which I did not know about this. I mean, I'd heard of it, but I didn't know what it was. Could you explain to people? Because this boggles my mind.
Okay.
This is a thing.
So the White Australia policy, what was called the Immigration Act, basically it was the Immigration Act, Immigration Restriction Act. It came in, I think, in 1901. It was one of the first pieces of legislation passed by the Australian Federated Parliament. And it was initially aimed at keeping the Chinese out, I think. But over the years, our adaptive parliaments have used it to keep all sorts of people out. In 1934 and 35, they used it to try and keep Egon Kish out. And what the legislation is that for someone wanting to come into the country, there's an entrance test. Now, the entrance test isn't particularly difficult, but the Immigration Restriction Act permitted you to give that test in any language you chose.
This is the part that tells me, I'm like, how did that get approved?
Well, they thought they were being clever. So then they could say, no, we're still, you know, granting visas and letting people in, but they could just choose who they kept out. So presumably if you were an upstanding member of, you know, British society, you got given your test in English and everything was good. But when there was someone you wanted kept out of the country, then the test was applied in a language that they would be unlikely to complete the test
in. Gaelic.
Scottish Gaelic. Yeah. So Egon Kish was given the test in a number of languages. He passed a number because he was European and spoke seven languages. And then they pulled out Scottish Gaelic. And they gave him the test in Scottish Gaelic. And considering he was a communist, they had him transcribe, or they asked him to transcribe the Lord's Prayer in Scottish Gaelic. Which was quite an interesting twist that they added on. And, of course, I don't know that he failed. He refused to do it. He threw down the pen and said, this is ridiculous, this is a disgrace, and he refused to do it. And he was excluded on that basis and thrown into jail. Bearing in mind that at that time he was also sick, he'd broken his leg. But they sent him to prison for that. Now, the White Australia policy wasn't actually eradicated till the early 70s under the Whitlam government. So I was particularly interested in it because when my parents first applied to come to Australia, they were excluded because the White Australia policy was still in play. And at the time, it was the Whitlam government had just come in, and I was asked to give a speech for Australia Day in my hometown, and I was talking to my dad about this, and I said, well, you know, if they excluded you, why on earth did you want to come to Australia in the first place? I would have just taken my bat and ball and gone home. And he said, well, you know, the word in the world community was that Australians weren't racist, that this was just an anomaly that was left over and that it was on its way out. And in fact, the officer who applied the test and failed him had said to him, go somewhere for 5 years and then apply again. And things will have changed. And that's exactly what my family did and a lot of families that had been excluded did. And that's why I spent 5 years in Africa and learned to speak English in Zambia.
So if they had given you the dictation test, what language did they speak in Zambia?
Zambia, I think it's a Swahili, or they have a local dialect. But no, my father, because he had every intention of coming to Australia after the 5 years, he sent us to an international school where we learned to speak English at that time. So by the time we came to Australia when I was six, I spoke English. But it's not something that's been a big part of my life, but when I was looking at it, I hadn't realised that it had been used in such wild and imaginative ways in the past to keep political undesirables out of the country as well.
This wasn't influenced by anything that's going on world stage at the moment, was it?
It was. I've been really intrigued about how there is such a match-up between the 1930s and what's going on right now. And part of the tragedy of it is when I first started writing A Few Right Thinking Men, I was delighted with the fact that Australia didn't go down the fascist path and that we seem to be immune to that sort of thing. And I used to, talk about Australia being the only country where thousands of men could gather for revolution and then in the end just decide to go home and have tea. But what's happened since is that there has been a change, and a change in attitude and a change in politics. And you can see a similar tracking between what happened right through that decade and what's happening now. And the terrifying thing is the 1930s ended in war.
Not a small war.
No, not a small war. Not a small war. One that just sort of sucked in the world. And you hope that we have learned something from history, but you fear that we are just doing everything in exactly the same way again.
It's very scary.
Which is, the 1930s saw a similar rise in personality and cults of personality, where you had these leaders who led by the force of their personality, and you saw them. You saw the 1929, the crash of the markets. You saw the GFC in our current situation. You see the move towards extremism after economic hardship. So it all seems to follow a pattern. So in a lot of ways, while I'm writing Rowley, I'm not necessarily writing about the 30s anymore. It seems sometimes that I'm writing a very contemporary piece.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So we've gone a bit longer than we should have, but you're just such a fascinating person to talk to. Thank you so much for coming in today and speaking to us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm such a huge fan of this series and delighted with this latest installment. Podcast listeners, you can get all of the Roland Sinclair books and every Sinclair books and every one of Sarai Gentle's books at www.booktopia.com.au.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.